WCKUT 90.3 FM.
Good morning, Montreal. You are tuned to the Wednesday Morning After on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. We have a full show for you today with two pre-recorded interviews and a Rabble podcast. The first interview is with Sarah Berman, author of Don't Call It a Cult by Penguin Random House Books. She goes into details about her time with Keith Raniere, who has been sentenced to 120 years for sex crimes. Trigger warnings are in effect. The second interview is with Ryan Henry Hook of Baby Boy and the Earthly Delights. Baby Boy is a joy to hear. Let's listen later in the show. The Rabble podcast is about global garment workers getting fair wages. 8 o'clock brings Democracy Now!, 8:15 brings Weather, and we'll wrap up the show. Let's start the day off with some music.
Yeah. Trusting me into a stone cold bitch who cries at night when emptiness doesn't feel so full anymore. But I can forgive. Could I even maybe forget? Even though it'll stick with me like a heavy stone in my shoe, confining me to the side of
The alert level in your region or a neighboring region is red. To curb the spread of COVID-19, gatherings with family and friends in private homes and yards are prohibited. Travel between regions should be avoided. It is forbidden to leave your home between 9:30 p.m. and 5 a.m. Visit quebec.ca/coronavirus to learn more about other measures in place to fight COVID-19. Follow all the rules, all the time, no exceptions. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Trigger warnings: sex trafficking, self-help coaching, forced labor, mentorship, multi-level marketing, gaslighting. Investigative journalist Sarah Berman explores the shocking practices of Nexium, an organization run by Keith Raniere and his high-profile enablers. Don't Call It a Cult shows that abuses look very different from the inside. With us today, we have Sarah Berman, author of Don't Call It a Cult. Hi, Sarah, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Sheila. Thanks for having me.
First, please introduce yourself and tell us how you came to be an author.
Sure. So I'm a reporter based in Vancouver for 10 years now, and I first started writing about Nexium, I would say, you know, while I was writing for Vice. I was an editor there for 4+ years, and I realized very quickly into reporting on that story that I had some sort of social connections, I would say. So for example, a bunch of friends of mine had gone to high school with one of the actresses that was really deep into this organization. And then I also had a roommate of a friend who had been tied into one of these arranged marriages in Nexium. So that got me thinking about how this was really close to me. These were people who were seemingly progressive, seemingly, you know, vegan and Hopi changey people. So I just tried to solve this contradiction of how can you have these seemingly change the world type people being involved in something so extreme? And, you know, could this have been me? Could this have been sort of one of my best friends? So that's how I got started writing about Nexium. And just over the reporting of it, it sort of started to look like it was gonna be a book. And I was sort of approached by publishers first before I even had that idea. So that's how it came to be.
How close did you have to get to Keith Raniere to write this story?
Well, definitely in court for 6 weeks. I was physically within, you know, 5 meters of him for all that time. But I also really got deep into his sort of brain and how he thinks, I guess. I read a lot of the books that were in his executive library, and I read a lot of the material, you know, for the trial, which included his text messages to women. So he really did start to get kind of inside my head. I would find his logic just popping up, especially at trial. So when you had somebody on the witness stand have an emotional outburst, immediately popping into my head is, you know, what that looked like from, you know, Keith's side of the defense table, right? He would think of that as, you know, a woman just having a tantrum and trying to get what she wants. That's sort of how his logic worked. And that seemed to be true because the next day his lawyers filed for, you know, a motion for a retrial just based on this, you know, one particular emotional outburst. So yeah, I would say I got unsettlingly close on the brain level.
In the appendix of the book, you write a letter to Raniere. Did you ever get to interview him, and did he answer your questions?
So, no, I mailed that letter to him while he was in jail in Brooklyn, and then I most recently sent it to his new lawyers who are taking over because he's trying to appeal his sentence, and I've never received a response. So, I mean, it is tough when you're interacting with somebody who has kind of proven themselves not super credible, like has proven to manipulate facts, and you really want to try and get to the truth. So the questions are phrased in a, you know, way that might seem confrontational to him. Yeah, still waiting on that response.
Raniere's organization, Nexium, can't be called anything short of a cult. Why the name of your book, Don't Call It a Cult?
Yeah, so that title isn't really because, you know, I or experts don't think it's a cult. It's actually sort of a tongue-in-cheek sort of reference. So early in the book, when I meet one of the early whistleblowers, Sarah Edmondson, she, you know, was describing all these extremely, you know, checked all the boxes in terms of what a cult is, right? So, you know, her sleep and food intake were controlled. She was branded, and, you know, she was bowing to a photo of Keith Raniere wearing these sashes, just a whole lot of culty things. And then when I asked her, you know, so when did it feel like, okay, yeah, I'm in a cult here? And initially she did go along with that question. And then suddenly she went sort of pale and looked a little bit frightened even, and said, you know, the C word, I can't say it. It's not going to work. Can you please edit that out? And that was one of many sort of upside down, what is happening moments for me as a reporter. I didn't quite understand yet how, you know, fear and, you know, how much backlash ex-members really were receiving. So at that point, she was fearing lawsuits and, you know, but other kinds of backlash from the group just for using that word. But there's other reasons too. When Keith was tried, the prosecutors didn't actually need to open that can of worms. They didn't have expert testimony on it. You know, they didn't need to prove it was a cult or not. And that weirdly seemed comforting to, you know, not focus on this, you know, not easily defined word, right? Like a bunch of experts have different definitions, you know, and Keith Raniere, his team had deflections and explanations for all of it. So it didn't feel necessary. And so they just didn't do it. And then also, if you're chatting with somebody who might be entangled in a group like this, it really helps. Like, if you use that word, cult, you're going to get shut down very quickly. That was really sort of beaten into a lot of the Nexium members and a lot of similar groups. It's the same. So are best suited to come around to it in a way where you're there in good faith and you're, you know, just trying to learn more and get them to start asking questions and see inconsistencies. So that's a bit of the reason why it's called Don't Call It a Cult.
May we listen to you read a few pages of your novel?
Sure. It's not a novel. It's nonfiction.
So it is documentary, but I noticed that it is fictionalized documentary, where you repeat conversations and you put them into scenes so that you're actually carried along with each action of the characters. And right. They are characters at that point. So
yeah, you're right. It is fictionalized. Cinematic. Yeah. So I'm just going to read right from the top, the prologue, The Most Ethical Man.
Okay.
Keith Raniere needed sleep. That much was clear. How much sleep? Well, for decades before his arrest in March 2018, that was a point of debate. Some thought he slept only 1 or 2 hours a night. But women close to him knew he was more of a day sleeper. And that day in March, in an upstairs bedroom of a $10,000 a week vacation rental north of Puerto Vallarta, Raniere was napping. According to testimony at Raniere's trial, actors Nikki Klein and Allison Mack were lounging outside on a patio overlooking an infinity pool when Mexican federal agents in bulletproof vests pulled up the cobblestone driveway. Armed with a warrant from the Eastern District of New York for sex trafficking and forced labor, the officers surrounded the property. Some of them appeared to be wearing masks and holding machine guns. It was a big deal for Klein and Mack, celebrities and recent subjects of relentless online gossip, to be staying so close to Raniere. 5 months earlier, he'd been accused in the New York Times of masterminding a strange blackmail scheme, and allegations that Raniere had sexually abused young girls were resurfacing online with a vengeance. The U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation wasn't quiet about its interest in Nexium, the secretive self-help company Raniere had founded in 1998. The feds had interviewed Nexium associates in the United States and left business cards with allies in Mexico, asking for Raniere to get in touch. Despite all this, Klein and Mack had come to Mexico to show their commitment to Raniere, whom they'd often called the most ethical man they'd ever met. Raniere was technically a fugitive, but his hideout in Mexico resembled an expensive corporate retreat. A team of fixers had been buzzing around him, first in Punta Mita, and now at their current location, a remote beach town of Chacala. Neighbors said they went on long walks and ordered expensive butter-infused coffees from a tourist bar. Testimony later revealed they communicated through prepaid disposable phones. Mack and Klein had been invited to participate in a, quote, recommitment ceremony. The plan was to show loyalty to Ranieri in the most vulnerable way possible, which might have included group sex had the cops not shown up that day. Under her clothes, each actor bore a scar in the shape of Ranieri's initials, burned into her skin with a cauterizing pen more than a year earlier. It symbolized her lifelong commitment to obeying Ranieri's every request. Before getting caught up in Nexium headlines, Nikki Klein had been best known for her role as Callie on the sci-fi drama Battlestar Galactica, while Allison Mack had lit up TV screens as Chloe Sullivan, the best friend to Superman in the CW show Smallville. Those roles had become less interesting to the women as they grew more committed to changing the world with Ranieri. Through thousands of hours of coursework and mentorship, Klein and Mack had learned to break out of limiting beliefs. Nexium students compared this process to Keanu Reeves taking the red pill in The Matrix. No aspect of their lives was exempt from constant study, reflection, and redefinition. Ranieri taught that everything was an opportunity for personal growth, even a face-off with federal agents. As police moved inside, at least one of Ranieri's disciples was feeling some doubts. For Lauren Salzman, the daughter of Nexium's president and co-founder Nancy Salzman, Ranieri's arrest punctured a bubble of secrecy and deception that had protected his reputation as someone of the highest ethical standards. Salzman was in a bedroom with Ranieri when the cops came upstairs to take him into custody. As she later recalled at his trial, Ranieri hid in a walk-in closet, leaving her to face the police. "They were banging on the door," she testified. "The whole time I was thinking they could just shoot through the door." As the door rattled on its frame, Salzman asked to see a warrant. "Open the door and I'll show it to you," an agent replied. Salzman didn't open the door. The cops kicked it open and pinned her to the floor. With guns pointed at her, she yelped out Ranieri's name. The man, known to acolytes as Vanguard, Master, and Grandmaster, stepped out of the closet and was cuffed on the floor and taken downstairs. For Salzman, Ranieri's arrest left a small but significant crack in the edifice he'd built. "I chose what I believed we had been training for this entire time, which was to choose love over everything, including the possibility of losing my life," she later testified. "There was no need to send me in to shield him or negotiate with them. He could have just protected us all and just gone." For months, Salzman felt guilty for not doing more to protect Ranieri. It would take the better part of a year for her to realize that the flaw she saw in him that day went much deeper. "It never occurred to me that I would choose Keith and Keith would choose Keith," she said.
Thank you for that lovely piece of the book. That gives us a good opening on to the story, doesn't it?
I think so, yeah.
So Keith Ranieri's crimes were mostly sexual in nature. Why do women choose to be sexually and intellectually abused?
Well, so I think the point of this book was to illustrate exactly what the women were choosing when they came to Nexium. So they joined for community, they joined for their ambitions to change the world. You know, they wanted to network and build their acting career. They wanted to build, you know, the grit they needed to be the best at something. They didn't choose to be, you know, subjected to this sort of system of coercion and influence that basically, yeah, that was what created sort of this false choice where they either had to, you know, go along with what was being done to them, which was, in my opinion, a very messed up situation, or choose to lose all hope and purpose and all their important relationships. So I think even though in a situation like this, it looks like a choice, I'm hoping just the breakdown of all the steps along the way, you can see that this was an unfair system of coercion and control. And so these weren't barely given choices. None of the women signed up because they wanted to be part of, you know, a quote unquote sex cult. None of them wanted that from the beginning. That was just something that they were, you know, coerced into.
Given your choice, what would Ranieri's fate have been?
That's an excellent question. Definitely in this case, the sentence is a pretty intense number. So the judge, Nicholas Garifas, actually chose 120 years total. So that was, you know, pretty much the maximum on a lot of the charges. And I can see why that would be viewed as maybe a lot, you know, like maybe not fitting what happened here. But I think he laid out the questions that he was asking himself when he made the decision. And it really was based on just this coordinated response that Ranieri and his loyalists, you know, had mounted to sort of discredit almost the whole justice system entirely, and this very skewed, you know, impoverished view of the facts of the case. And so I think he was reacting to that, the fact that they wanted to overturn the whole thing and were coordinating to do that. So this was sort of a, I guess, because a lot of the U.S. justice system is based on, you know, are you sorry? Have you, you know, actually sort of repented in some way? He just didn't feel that was happening in this case, and that the danger, you know, for him to continue controlling people outside of a prison was very real. So, yeah, I guess I don't think it's my place to put a number on a sentence, but I do think there's a reason to explain sort of how we arrived at this point that may seem shocking. I don't know if that directly answers your question, but yeah, I can see why 120 years was the result here.
You deferred to the judge. That's fair enough.
Yeah. I mean, that's who ultimately in any justice system decides a sentence usually.
If our listeners want to buy your book, where should they go?
Well, I would recommend checking out just whatever local indie bookstore is your favorite, and you can ask them. They'll have it for pre-order. The release date is April 20th. Or there's an alternative through the launch event that I'm doing on April 15th. So you can find that link at bit.ly/don't call it a cult, all one word. That's mostly, you can buy the book through that link, but it's, the benefit is that you can pick it up early if you're in Vancouver. So I don't know if your listeners will be in Vancouver, but you can pick it up on the 15th via that link. You have some Vancouver listeners out there.
We have listeners all over Canada, all over the world, in fact.
Awesome.
Thank you for your interview today.
Of course. It's been excellent. Thank you for having me.
You have been listening to Sarah Berman speaking about her book, Don't Call It a Cult. I am your host, Sheila Ferrando.
Early in the morning, before the sun rose, when the first bird sang, even while everyone was still asleep.
Morning. On that morning.
When the sun.
Cocky-doodle-doo, I hear the rooster crowing.
Now you must wake up.
Now every morning when I wake up,
I woke up this morning with
the kiss of the morning.
Got up 7:30 every morning, had the same breakfast.
Réveillez-moi à 8 heures demain matin.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Bacon and eggs.
In the morning.
In the morning.
In the morning.
Why should the sun replace the moonlight?
Has this ever happened to any of you, or will it happen to any of you, on the morning after the night before?
You are listening to The Morning After on CKUT 90.3 on the FM dial.
What do surrealist painter Hieronymus Bosch and reggae have in common? Both artistic expressions are at the forefront of the roots rock reggae-inspired group Baby Boy and the Earthly Delights. Led by the charismatic and zany Baby Boy, songs from the Earthly Delights contain halcyon guitar melodies, sultry horns, and lyrics steeped in fable, myth, nature, and the human condition. With us today, we have Ryan of Baby Boy and the Earthly Delights. Hi, Ryan, and welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
First, please introduce yourself and tell us how you came to be involved with Baby Boy and the Earthly Delights.
Yeah, so my name is Ryan Hook, aka Baby Boy. And the band kind of has been my own personal passion project for about 4 years. It's gone through a variety of variations. I've been the drummer, I've been the bassist, I've kind of carried the band through every woe and good moment. And now with this setup that I have with the horns and everyone in the band, I finally got a setup that works and feels good and just feels right.
What You Want Ain't What You Need is your latest single. What is the story behind this song?
Yeah, I mean, I hate to give too much of what a song means away, but all I can tell you is what it means to me right now, and that it's a sort of call to action for each generation to kind of wake up and plant that seed of spiritual, emotional, and mental revolution. Within the scope of the concept of the band, this song actually plays a bigger narrative role in a bigger story.
May we hear some of your music?
Yes, let's rock it.
This is What You Want on the Wednesday Morning After. How did you get the name Baby Boy and the Earthly Delights?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I was going through a lot of band names, but the latter half of the band kind of comes from a Hieronymus Bosch painting called The Garden of Earthly Delights. And it depicts the Garden of Eden, Earth, and the River Styx in a triptych. I was really inspired by that painting because I feel like it's one of the first surrealistic paintings. And it came from the 1600s, if I'm correct. And then Baby Boy, the first part, is technically my birth name. When parents don't have a name for their child, immediately they need to write something on a live birth certificate. And often they just give the sex of whatever the baby is. Therefore, I was given Baby Boy after my sex. And I've actually met other people named Baby Boy and Baby Girl throughout my life. So the idea behind the band is sort of a newborn going through the trials and tribulations of heaven, earth, and hell, the human condition.
What themes and issues do you deal with when you compose your songs?
Yeah, when I'm composing songs, lyrics kind of just fall out of my mouth generally, and they generally speak to myself. But they kind of speak to like nature, myth, fable, and the human condition, sort of what you said before. When I'm writing songs, I'm kind of speaking to myself, and the songs come really natural. I write music because it just falls out of my mouth. It's a really pure expression for me, especially as someone who is also a writer and as a professional medium.
What is the process you go through when you produce a song?
Yeah, producing music is kind of the opposite of writing a song. It's more of a method. Everything in the songs are really intentional. There are themes and concepts I really want to express in this band. And this band is very much an artistic concept as it is a band, as pretentious as that sounds, but it's very intentional in what I put it.
May we hear some more of your music?
Yes, please.
This is Day by Day on CKUT.
For every rock, there's a stepping stone, one that takes you further than before. And I can go your way, but I'll go my way too. And when this world finally comes to an end, I will be right there beside you, remembering all the words you said. Like, take it day by day, my friend. Take it day by day, my friend. Day by day, my friend. For every seed, there's a growing tree. One's growing taller than before. And I'll just sit underneath. I'll watch those trees get high. And when this world finally comes to an end, I will be right there beside you, remembering all the words you said.
Day by day, my friend.
Take it day by day, my
Take it day by day, my friend.
Take it day by day, my this war finally comes to an end, I'll be right there, right there, beside you.
If our listeners want some free listening time or just want to buy your music, where should they go?
Yes, we have our Bandcamp. If you look up babyboyhook.bandcamp.com, you can buy our music for $1 or check out our early demos for free. You can also look up our band name in Spotify, Tidal, or Apple Music, wherever you stream your music, just Baby Boy and the Earthly Delights. And then we also have a YouTube page that has some live videos and all of our recordings for free that you can jam out to all summer.
Well, thank you for your interview today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Ryan from Baby Boy and the Earthly Delights, speaking about his band and his music. I am your host, Sheila Ferrando.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is now underway for priority groups. Visit quebec.ca/COVID vaccine to follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book your appointment online. If necessary, you can also call 1-877-644-4545. Once you've been vaccinated, it's important to continue to protect yourself by following the basic health guidelines. The vaccine, a safe way to protect ourselves. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
The alert level in your region or a neighboring region is red. To curb the spread of COVID-19, gatherings with family and friends in private homes and yards are prohibited. Travel between regions should be avoided. It is forbidden to leave your home between 9:30 p.m. and 5 a.m. Visit quebec.ca/coronavirus to learn more about other measures in place to fight COVID-19. Follow all the rules, all the time, no exceptions. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's radio. Free radio.
This is Solidarity News on Radio Labour.
This is a Radio Labour Canada report recorded on Friday, April 2nd, 2021. I'm Marc Boulanger. In the report this week, a special program about the plight of garment workers in Bangladesh and what the steel workers are doing to help them. Plus, the Labour Start report about union events and singing.
For every stitch of clothing, someone sweats away while the tangled threads of justice unravel at the seams. From the slums of New York City to the streets of Bangladesh, 100 years of struggle, it ain't over yet.
This is Radio Labor.
These are the women we are talking about, who are pulling their legs and fighting to have their union voice at work street, who are fighting to have a safe workplace, who are fighting to have a gender-based violence-free workplace.
If you had a company that is sourcing its product from there and has witnessed those conditions, I just honestly, from my upbringing, I just don't know how anybody goes to bed with a clear conscience.
Garment workers in Bangladesh are employed in dangerous jobs which don't even pay them a living wage. The country has 4,000 factories which employ about 4 million workers, mostly young women. In an attempt to help the workers and their families, the United Steelworkers has released a report which traces the connections between companies in Canada and specific factories in Bangladesh. The report is called Not Even the Bare Minimum. To find out more about the report and the situation in Bangladesh, I talked to Kalpona Akhtar and Ken Newman. Ms. Akhtar is the president of the Bangladesh Garment and Industrial Workers Federation and executive director of the Bangladesh Center for Workers' Solidarity. Mr. Newman is the Steelworkers National Director for Canada. I reached Ms. Akhtar in her office in Bangladesh and asked her to describe the workers the report focused on.
They're basically factory workers who produce clothes for these brands. They're sewers, like machine operators, who sew the clothes. These are the young female workers who are making clothes in those factories. Majority of them young female workers. These are the young female workers who had a dream. They came from the countryside and they had a dream that when they come to the city and get the job, and these jobs will change their life, okay? They will have respectable wages, they will have a good life. But when they come into the city and getting job in the factory, their dream never come true. They ending up their life with a poverty wages jobs. The minimum wage is, you know, $105 Canadian, kind of close to that, a month, which is not enough for one person, full month cost, let alone if they have children in the family. These women pulling their life in this long shifting hour in those factories, they don't have any savings, nor they do have a house, which we can call a decent house. These women workers, over 30% of their wages for their housing only. It's a rental house. It's not a dream house. It's like 10 by 10 concrete room. Sometimes they doesn't have windows. These are the women export income for the country, like 80% of our export income coming from this garment industry. But these women's life is not safe.
The report about the Bangladeshi garment workers is entitled Not Even the Bare Minimum. It was commissioned by the Humanity Fund of the Steelworkers in Canada. Ken Newman is president of the fund, as well as being the Steelworkers National Director for Canada. I asked him what the report Not Even the Bare Minimum does.
First of all, what the report does is that we've been able to identify specific garment factories in Bangladesh that supply five different Canadian retailers. You've got Hudson's Bay Company, you've got Joe Fresh, you've got Marks, you've got Nygaard, and you've got Lululemon. And what the report shows is that the women who sew our clothes are earning only $6 or $7 per day. And I say not per hour, this is per day. And in our view, that isn't even enough, not nearly enough, even in Bangladesh for a worker to have a decent life or to pay for reasonable housing, nutritious food, transportation, clothing, children's education, health care, and all the other essentials to try to save something for a future for a rainy day. So that's what has come out of this report. We see that some of these workers are just living, not having a living wage. That's why this report is important.
What are you asking companies to do?
Well, first and foremost, we're asking Canadian garment brands and retailers to, first of all, publicly acknowledge that they have a responsibility for workers in their global supply chains. And there are two urgent things that we're asking the Canadian brands that they can do immediately. The first one is to make an explicit public commitment that they will ensure that their suppliers pay workers their full wages and benefits through this pandemic. And secondly, is that they commit to contributing to what is called a global severance guarantee fund that will ensure workers are never left penniless when they lose their jobs. This means that they would be entering into a legal binding agreement to pay a premium price of 1.5% on each garment that's ordered. So that's really what we're asking the Canadian companies to make a commitment to immediately up front.
You can find more information about the United Steelworkers Humanity Fund report on Canadian companies and Bangladesh garment workers on the union's website at usw.ca. Here with his report about union events is Labour Star correspondent Derek Blackadder.
Some of the big stories in our Canadian news pages this week included the reaction of the FTQ and other central unions to the Quebec government's latest offer to them in broader public sector bargaining. We also covered CUPW's renewed push to expand the services offered by Canada Post as part of the pandemic recovery, and a demo at a Canadian shipping company's office in Sydney, Australia, organized by the Maritime Union of Australia in solidarity with Canadian seafarers. The MUA has a long history of international solidarity actions involving Canada. The union was a major funder of a spectacular documentary history of the Canadian Seamen's Union by British Columbia filmmaker Elaine Briere, which detailed how the militant Canadian Seamen's Union was destroyed by the federal government. The MUA comes by its commitment to global solidarity honestly, as do most maritime transport unions affiliated with the International Transport Workers Federation. Check out the ITF's Global News website to get a sense of just how active transport workers here in Canada and elsewhere around the world have been as they face the effects of the pandemic on their members' livelihoods and health. Canadian labor history items on our site for this week included the 1903 walkout by 2,000 Montreal dockers, an anniversary especially appropriate this week as bargaining at the Port of Montreal continues with a strike by QP imminent. Among the Canadian stories on our Working Women page this week were coverage of the legal challenge filed this week in an effort to overturn the criminal code penalties for sex work, warnings from several unions representing long-term care workers in Ontario that a provincial government decision to appeal a court pay equity ruling in favor of the women workers will not go unchallenged, and an obituary for Catherine McLeod, longtime feminist writer and trade union staffer. CanCon on our Global Health and Safety Newswire included coverage of PSAC's efforts to get border services staff onto provincial vaccination priority lists and Unifor's push to have the British Columbia government make paid leave to receive a vaccination mandatory. Globally, the big stories we covered included the coordinated global strikes last week that caused Deliveroo's initial public offering to, in the words of one business newspaper, completely tank. That was it for good news this week, I'm afraid. Sadly and in anger, we also carried stories about the death of a CTUM youth leader at the hands of the Myanmar army and yet another assassination of a trade union leader in the Philippines. Current campaigns that we are running at the requests of unions around the world, or in this case Canada, includes an urgent appeal for online solidarity with locked-out Toronto brewery workers. Look for details on our Canadian news page. This is Derek Blackadder from Labour Start, reporting for Radio Labour.
Now here are the Low Tide Drifters with Every Stitch.
Of clothing someone sweats away unseen, while the tangled threads of justice unravel at the seams. From the slums of New York City to the streets of Bangladesh, 100 years of struggle, it ain't over yet.
In the ashes of disaster, New York's union stood to fight. stitch of clothing someone sweats away unseen. While the tangled threads of justice unravel at the seams. From the slums of New York City to the streets of Bangladesh. 100 years of struggle, it ain't over yet.
And that's it, labor news you can use. You can find our international features and daily newscasts at radiolabor.net. Follow us on Twitter at Radio Labor. I'm Mark Belanger. Thank you for listening. And remember, it's all about solidarity.
Now more than ever, the simplest gestures are our best protection to fight the virus. That's why we need to continue following basic health measures, such as keeping a 2-meter distance from others, wearing a mask and washing our hands regularly. Avoid travel and non-essential trips. And if you develop symptoms, be sure to get tested promptly and follow self-isolation guidelines. See all of the measures in place at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Let's continue to protect ourselves. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
You're listening to the Wednesday Morning After Show with your host, Sheila Ferrando, on CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal, or worldwide at ckut.ca.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Minnesota, the doctor who tried to save George Floyd's life at a Minneapolis emergency room last May testified Monday asphyxia was the likely cause of Floyd's death, with no evidence Floyd was killed by a heart attack or drug overdose. Dr. Bradford Langenfeld's testimony came as the second week of former police officer Derek Chauvin's murder trial got underway. Also testifying was Minneapolis Police Chief Arredondo, who told prosecutors Chauvin violated department policies and showed a disregard for life when he kneeled on George Floyd's neck for over 9 minutes. It was a rare instance of a police chief testifying against a former officer.
But once there was no longer any resistance, and clearly when Mr. Floyd was no longer responsive and even motionless, to continue to apply that level of force to a person proned out, handcuffed behind their back, that in no way, shape, or form is anything that is by policy, is not part of our training, and it is certainly not part of our ethics or our values.
Police Chief Arredondo is among a number of high-ranking law enforcement officials who've condemned Derek Chauvin's actions during the trial. Yet Chauvin racked up 18 complaints over his 19-year career as a police officer, raising questions about why he remained on active duty at the